All right, this is Pure Decking for Thursday. What the hell is today? May the 10th. Insert whatever year makes you happy here. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, pointing out just how rigged the game is. And as a reminder, if you think there's a population problem, maybe you should start with yourself. I'm Morps, and tonight I have RU. RU, what are you drinking?
God damn, that was dark, man. Just a straight up kill yourself. What am I drinking? I'm drinking a large glass of cold goddamn water.
I may have gotten into a political argument with some people earlier in the week, and I'm not bitter. No, not at all. Madman, what are you drinking?
Drinking a flat tire amber ale.
And I'm on my last Kentucky bourbon barrel ale. I'll have to go buy some more. So, I don't know. I didn't think it was, you think it was that dark? I mean, really?
Nah, this show usually ends up wanting me to commit suicide anyway.
Yeah, well, there you go. And that's just me playing with the soundboard, let alone what we talk about. speaking of the soundboard, I use a Numark Orbit to trigger the sound clips. It's a little wireless MIDI controller, and the battery in it was about shot, so I had it plugged in, and it's flipping the hell out now. That's why it's trying to play Alex Jones and God knows what else. So we're just going to set that.
Become sentient.
We're just going to set that down. I plugged it into the other computer to charge just because it was the closest open USB port. And halfway through the intro, the other computer decides it's time to detect this as a MIDI controller and disconnects it from the wireless. It's like, what the fuck? So, oh, God, are you? Don't post those kind of pictures during the show. I'm going to click it, and then I'm going to... So, for reference, people, RU has posted us a lovely image of someone who I'm guessing is a furry because they've tattooed a tail on their back.
Bad life decisions, 101, man.
Yeah, you
point
know,
it
you...
out so you don't have to.
Ooh, I think he may have been a Sonic fan, too. That looks like Tails' tail.
God damn it, Madman. Don't specify where the fucking... Oh.
So, from now on, Madman is our furry connoisseur and expert. So, whenever...
Ooh, a title I never wanted. Thank you.
whenever we have political questions or questions about how the furry crowd's going to react, that's your beat. Anyways...
Oh, dude, if Madman ever goes missing, we put his... picture up on the news, and we're going to let everyone know that he's an expert in identifying furry tails. Have you seen this man? He's an expert. Maybe found.
Oh, Lord. Anyways. Shit. I guess we can just go straight into it. Oh, right. We did miss the show last week. For anybody who normally listens live, the stream got completely broken last week. The account was screwed over. We had all kinds of problems with it. It wasn't really till Saturday evening that I got everything up and working again. So if you go to the website and it says the stream's unavailable, you probably have the web player cached. Clear the cache, refresh the page, hold shift and hit refresh. Sometimes that'll get it to go without having to completely clear the cache. Or just wait a bit, you know. If you click the link for the M3U off the web player, that should bring up a... it hasn't been an M3U for a long time. It's been a PLS, but whatever. Anyways, that's just how old the graphics we're using are. I've got some ideas. I know I say that all the time, but it's like, man, I might get annoyed with the web page enough to actually do something with it this time. I don't know. Anyways, so yeah, if you do... like listening to the stream live, yeah, get the web page refreshed because it is working now. I've verified it on multiple machines, separate machines. It's just if you have the old one cached, it'll still try to connect to a server that's no longer there. So yeah, the IP address changed and everything. So not really much I can do about that, unfortunately. So.
But it's the fact that they didn't let us know. They just canceled the account overnight.
Yeah, that really is what happened.
No email, nothing. Just like, hi, your account's been canceled. And we're sitting there going, oh, fuck. What? Oh, shit. Did we get hashtagged me too? or as I like to call it, pound me too. You know?
Yeah, yeah, no, and we
very
have
bizarre.
We have to shoot him a support ticket. It's like, I'm locked out of my account. It says I'm disabled, and I don't know why. We haven't gotten any emails, and they're like, oh yeah, here, look at this, and they shoot me a link that's, you know, a couple of pages deep into their site where they've got the bulletin posted that the server that runs our stream was being decommissioned, and that all of it had to get moved to a new one. And yeah, so they just turned the stream off rather than, I don't know, an email.
And then they didn't move the information on the server. We had to find it and move it. And by we, I mean Morps.
Well, yeah, that actually took a chunk of time last weekend. Friday and Saturday was, well, not all day Saturday. I did some other things, put about 200 some odd rounds to a new handgun, but other than that, yeah, it took some time to fix. Oh yeah, are you Psychros loves your joke. Anyways,
I vowed not to do one this week.
What, another pound me too?
Oh, the pound me too. Yeah, look, you think about it, half the world still thinks of that as the pound sign.
That's what I grew up calling it.
Exactly, and only recently, hashtag, it's pound sign, motherfucker.
Well, that's the symbol, sure, pound. Anybody who ever, you know, actually, hell, most modern telecom systems still say, you know, the pound or hash sign. So, thanks, Twitter, for changing that. Anyways, I guess we can go ahead and move on here. First article is from the Register, and it is a kind of a roll-up summary of the Equifax stuff. Because it's pretty bad to the point that we probably need to come up with new ways to verify people's identity at this point, because all the old ones are out. They're done. Too many people's had their had their info leaked. So Equifax has go ahead.
I was just thinking the only way, if you're going down that road, every PC has a thumbprint scanner. As you sit down in the morning, don't you scan? And that electronic verifies your accounts or something?
Some machines do.
Yeah.
I'm currently using a different set of hardware tokens, not a fingerprint reader. But that's actually because my index fingers, I apparently don't have fingerprints anymore. No reader can actually pick up my index fingers. I have to use... Well, usually I use a ring finger, but occasionally, for a while, I was using the middle finger because it was just a great joke to make. So, yeah, I had to flip off every fingerprint reader I used. And, but yeah, I have no index fingerprints, apparently. I don't know how I've accomplished this because I'm a computer nerd. I don't type that hard, I don't think, but.
Ballast or lack of oil in that particular area of your body?
Well, you know, decade and a half ago, I worked at, you know, growing up, worked as a cashier at a grocery store, and your hands used to get really fucked up doing that. And you wouldn't expect it, but it's because you're handling cold and wet stuff all day long as you scan it. And yeah, that'll fuck up your hands. So
plus the bacteria on the money you're handling.
Oh, absolutely. So my index fingers have actually never really recovered from that. So maybe that's part of it, but... Anyways, off topic, Equifax has published yet more details on the personal records and sensitive information stolen by miscreants. Miscreants, not thieves, not... damn editorial. Anyways, stolen by miscreants after they hacked its databases in 2017. The good news, the number of individuals affected by the network intrusion has not increased from 146.6 million. That's good news. Equifax previously announced, but extra type of records accessed by hackers have turned up in Mandiant's ongoing audit of the security breach. In February, in response to questions from U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Equifax agreed that card expiration dates and tax IDs could have been amongst the siphon data, but it hasn't worked out how many people were affected. Last week, the company gave the numbers and letters to various U.S. congressional committees investigating the network infiltration, and on Monday submitted a letter to the SEC. They waited over a year to submit the letter to the SEC. Wow. America's corporate financial watchdog. No, it's not quite a year. It was No, it was May that it happened, and it wasn't until June or July. Was it July that it was announced? I think it was July. But yeah, yeah, so it's
good
right
news,
out of year.
They can fake being businesses as well as people.
Yeah, as well as the 146 million names, 146.6 million dates of birth, 145.5 million social security numbers, 99 million address information, and 209,000 payment cards. That's the number and their expiration date exposed. The company said there are also 38,000 American driver's license and 3,200 passport details.
Ooh.
Why does Equifax have passports?
I don't know.
It's a form of ID. Whenever you're doing a credit check, they usually ask for multiple forms of ID. Some people, instead of handing a social security card, and a passport, driver's license, and a passport are both valid picture ID.
From now on, whenever I'm asked for a second form of ID, I'm going to hand them a firearm permit because I want to see the next one being firearm permits lifted in the data breach. Just because I want to see some poor yuppie reporter forced to write that.
That'd go nuts.
The further details emerged after Mandiant's investigations helped standardize certain data elements for further analysis to determine the consumers whose personally identifiable information was stolen. The extra data elements, the company said, didn't involve any individuals not already known to be part of the super hack. Super hack, really? That's what we're calling it? So no additional consumer notifications are required. I don't know. When the number's that big, shouldn't somebody just like show up at their corporate offices, line up everyone on the board of directors, bend them over, and kick them square in the nards? I mean,
a ceremonial samurai sword, and who's in charge? Yeah, kill yourself. On the board desk, so everybody knows not to fuck up next time.
The cyber break-in occurred because Equifax ran an unpatched and therefore insecure version of Apache Struts, something it blamed on a single employee. Yeah, because that's totally... So, as somebody who works
in... God damn it, Bill.
Somebody who works in this field, dude, believe me, if you can say... If a company is the size of Equifax says a single employee caused that mistake, you have... That means your entire IT operations, change control, change management, inventory, asset, audit is all in question. If a single employee can leave an unpatched server like that, and nobody else catches it and documents it and at least notes an exception, what the fuck is your IT department doing?
Not to mention how much the guy must have been getting paid to be in charge of all of that.
No kidding, right?
Oh, no, they found the minimum wage slot that they could fucking hang this on and shoot.
Habib, you're fired.
Good news, you're in a different country. I doubt they'll extradite you. Bad news, the CIA also has a station there. Live the rest of your life in fear.
Well, it looks like he's off to Pakistan.
So, anyways, yeah, at this point, between that and several of the other breaches that are out there, I think it's time to start coming up with some sort of another way of doing identification, at least as far as credit and reporting and services like that are. Because socials and driver's license numbers or pretty much any government-issued number like that, I mean, if the number can get out and be abused, it obviously doesn't work. I mean, physical tokens, maybe not RSA tokens, YubiKeys, maybe? I don't know if anybody knows what those are. Little USB security chips that, they get tied to an account and you can use those, but... I mean, the problem is anything issued like that, you'd have to issue one to everyone, and then you end up managing it, and it just becomes another social security number once it gets breached. It's just, in this case, you're going to make it a hell of a lot more complex.
Well, I know in India and Pakistan, they're using the phone SIM cards. Once you can only have one SIM card, and it must be registered to you by name, and all done by biometrics as well.
Well, considering a lot of modern smartphones have, like we were talking about a minute ago, a fingerprint reader or the retinal scanner. And of course, the iPhone has the Mini Kinect in it that does a face scan.
Yeah, but they're currently doing that. I think they're going to be finished by 2020. They'll have the entire population completely digitally scanned. So all their biometrics taken.
How hard is it to spoof a SIM card?
You just need the numbers off of it.
Yeah.
However,
no, it's a social security number.
To clone it, you do usually have to get malware on the phone or physical access to the phone.
I mean, it's just another thing yet to be pwned.
The way you would do it, if you want to at least secure the system this is supposed to be, instead of relying on a credit score, manually underwrite every loan. It means it would be slower to get credit. You're not going to get one of these, you've been pre-approved for a credit card in the mail, because you have to actually actively seek credit. Show up with, here are my paycheck stubs for the last year, and my name's Bob, here's my ID, here are the bills that I've been paying. Do you trust the information I'm giving you? Will you give me a credit card or a loan? It lengthens the process, but it's what we were doing up until, the 50s? So it's already there. You're just kind of backtracking a bit. And then there's no centralized database to steal, to hack into and steal and get people's credit information.
Well, you know, you say it would slow things down, but if you think about it, if you did manual, I mean, you think of some of the data processing systems that have been put together by companies that are mining personal data. You know, if you took, and instead of doing, you know, Google searches or Facebook likes or whatever the fuck, you could take a lot of these same data design systems. A lot of them are open source. And you could apply that to the manual underwriting process. And even though, yes, you're doing manual underwriting, and yes, you still have to, you know, validate some information and get information. You know, you wouldn't just, you know, get all that, you know, pre-offers and pre-screen shit. It wouldn't be as slow as you think. You could do all that underwriting with modern data processing. It wouldn't be that bad. Instead of having an answer in, you know, 5 minutes while you wait, it might be like a day just as they get all the information they need gathered up. But the actual processing of all that, you'd automate that.
Yeah, that's the way you would do it. Now, that would mean instead of going after TransUnion or Equifax, they're going back to trying to break into banks, but I think they're already trying to break into banks, so...
Trying to break into everything,
same
dude.
Problem.
So... Psychros is talking about government-issued PGP keys. I'd be worried about those getting compromised. Just, I mean, it's certainly more complicated, and you probably wouldn't have the databases of private keys get released, because you know you do everything with the public key. I sort of like how
it has
SSL
nothing
starts.
To do with trusting them. They're already issuing us social security cards. They're doing it. You're just doing a different version of a social security card, maybe a better, more secure one.
Well, you know, the idea of everyone having public-private key crypto actually would be a lot more manageable than just a serial number. Because let's be real, that's what a social security number is. It's a serial number.
Yeah.
You know, it's the idea that knowledge of that number is supposed to be somewhat secret, but obviously it's not, especially with these kind of leaks. You know, with a PGP key, if it's properly any kind of public-private key, if it's properly managed, the private key exists on, like, some kind of physical security token or at least some kind of, you know, physically separate device, and that's used to verify identity and only used for that kind of thing. I mean, it could work, but I don't think most people would be disciplined enough to understand what this thing is. And, I mean, you could do it with a modern, you know, the modern credit card chip readers have enough space on it to hold that kind of thing, but then you got to trust that you don't have skimmers and other stuff like that collecting up these keys, and then the moment one of them gets leaked, you've got the same problem all over again. So
I have a radical solution to this problem.
All right, let's hear it.
Massive fines for Equifax and everybody in charge of Equifax that had their fingers on this. Prison. Maybe they will implement stronger security programs. maybe they'll pay for the proper people to handle that end. You know what I mean? If there's accountability, because I guarantee you in that article, there is no mention of prison time for anyone or accountability for Equifax.
I read the whole thing. I didn't hear anything about prison time.
Exactly. Even though they, well, I would say they pretty much threw out their duty of care to notify anyone when they, because they waited 9 months. Yeah, I think that they should be stripped of any accreditation to operate credit.
Well, they certainly didn't handle the so, okay, I don't disagree with you that they should be held accountable for failing to operate correctly on this, because, yeah, you should be notifying people quickly that this has happened. You should be trying to make amends about it. You shouldn't be hiding it and playing games and all this other crap that they've done. But at the end of the day, they are actually kind of a victim. Somebody broke into their systems, even though their systems were laughably insecure. So I kind of feel like, yeah, we ought to punish Equifax for running such a shoddy system. But they also ought to find the people who broke into their database. And I don't know. Let's get creative here. Drawing quarter?
Prison. Prison, man. Well, actually, probably give them jobs in security. Just saying, man.
Well, maybe.
I mean, there needs to be higher, more accountability of these companies that are handling transactions and stuff like that. Not for them to go, well, we were robbed. Like, you don't see a bank transporting cash in a flatbed, do you?
Well, you know, and that's an interesting thing you say that, because technically there's no rule that says a bank couldn't transport cash in a flatbed and keep your money in an alley behind the Piggly Wiggly. No bank does it because they won't be in business very long. But with Equifax and other companies, you know, there's not that many companies out there like it. But at the end of the real problem is that I have never personally chosen to do business with Equifax. I'm sure they have my information because somebody I've done business with has done business with Equifax. But it's sort of like when you order something online, 9 times out of 10, yeah, you don't get to pick who's shipping it or the carrier.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So the reason UPS and FedEx treats the end user like crap whenever they fuck up a package is because you're not the customer. The customer is the guy who paid the shipping back at Amazon. You know?
Yeah.
So I think Equifax kind of is the same thing. Their customers are banks and credit providers and you know, loan companies and stuff like that. They're not, you know, they piss off a bunch of consumers. They don't give a fuck.
Yeah. Because really, they're not damaging, because the bank's going, oh, shit, you lost all your crap as well? Fuck, welcome to the club.
So, I feel like with the banks, you can, you know, because it's consumer facing, you can choose not to do business with them and it will hurt their bottom line. With companies like Equifax and some of these other servicing companies, you don't have a hell of a lot of choice about doing business with them, so they're kind of insulated from the effects of the market a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is what I mean. There needs to be better rules governing those who are overseeing this. Because, as you said, we can't vote with our wallets. So maybe they need to be held accountable by government bodies.
Ooh. Passing something like banks must do their own credit servicing?
I'd be okay with that.
So they can't export it to a third party like Equifax. It's Bank of America is handling this. JP Morgan Chase is handling this.
Yeah, that could work.
All right, that's because I mean, like I said, I'm not certain what the fix here is, but it's so much people's personal data is out there now that trying to use that for any kind of identification purposes is kind of moot.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
How many Social Security cards did they say was on this one?
Million. No, it was more.
A million.
Than that. Hang on. I closed the tab because I was getting ready to move on to the Fortnite cheater story. 145.
That's names.
Here it is. 145.5 million Social Security numbers. It's a third of the U.S. What's the United States? 1.5 billion, something like that?
360 something million, maybe 370 now.
Oh, I was thinking something else. Okay, so yeah, half the U.S. population. Great.
Half the U.S. population, effectively.
Yeah, that.
I was about to wonder, because with large numbers, it sounds big, but how big is it? I was thinking of the ratio. But yeah, half is large enough that that's compromised. 50-50 chance of it not being the person.
Yeah, really. When, and Cycros is pointing out in the chat room, and that's not including kids, because kids probably aren't in the database.
Kids in the elderly.
1 second, I gotta fix a cable.
Yeah, it'd be just children and the elderly that they didn't get.
Elderly would have still been there.
That's better. Anyways, yeah, so I don't know. I feel like we need to come up with something else. But anyways, next article. This is from The Verge. The defendant is a cheater, said Epic Games in its October 2017 lawsuit against a 14-year-old boy. Nobody likes a cheater, and nobody likes playing with cheaters. Epic isn't the first game studio that's sued over cheating. There was a lawsuit over the PlayStation Game Enhancer, a console hardware hack, as early as 1999. And in 2008, Blizzard sued over World of Warcraft bots. And there have been lawsuits over cheating in RuneScape, MapleStory, and most recently Overwatch. For its part, Epic Games, the maker of the popular video game Fortnite, launched a slew of lawsuits in October against cheat makers and hosts of forums and channels where cheats were distributed. Epic Games v. Rogers is a little different in that the rest of the cases were filed along... from the rest of the cases that were filed alongside it. In fact, it's different from every other video game lawsuit before it, or a cheating lawsuit before it, partly because it drives into a legal gray area that usually passes as normal allowable conduct when you're not being a flagrant jerk about it. Epic Games doesn't claim that defendant CR has ever written a cheat, sold a cheat, or even run a forum that distributes cheats. CR is being sued for live streaming himself using a cheat he found online and linking to it in the YouTube description box.
Is... distributing a cheat because he linked the cheat in the box. And he's actively cheating. So they're going after the heroin addict, not just the dealer.
None of the other cases that have gone after mere cheaters, or have gone after mere cheaters themselves, according to Kendra Albert, a clinical instructor at Harvard Law, who's an expert on the law around video games. Albert does note that Jack's First Doer, although it was known as the RuneScape case, went after John Doe's who were using bots, but in that case, the company appeared to be using a lawsuit to identify bot using players through their PayPal accounts. Once it had the contact information, it dropped the lawsuit and banned the players and then sent out settlement letters. So they used the DMCA tactic there. Unlike that case, Epic versus Rogers identifies an actual individual targeting him directly. CR's full name has been widely reported in previous media coverage, but it has been redacted in legal proceedings ever since it was discovered that he's a minor. Other defendants have since been identified as minors and also have had their names redacted. The lawsuit gives a few examples of what Fortnite cheats can do. A cheat might enable the cheater to see through solid objects, teleport, impersonate another player by spoofing that player's name, or make moves other players cannot, such as a spin followed by an instant headshot to another player. They actually called out the 360 no-scope in a legal proceeding.
That is awesome.
I
swear, I just practice a lot, Your Honor. It's a super uber late here.
It's not clear what kind of cheat CR was using, but whatever it was giving him a huge leg up in Fortnite's Battle Royale mode, which splits up to 100 players against each other on a map. CR has a YouTube channel with over 8,000 subscribers. One day he was live streaming a demo of a Fortnite cheat when Epic issued a takedown. When YouTube took down his video down, he belligerently posted a second video in protest. Oh no, he made another post on YouTube. The second video did not get taken down immediately, but for some reason CR decided to make a new YouTube account to live stream the cheat again. The third video, keep in mind this is all happening on the same day, October the 14th, got taken down. Defendant has been banned at least 14 times for violating the terms and the EULA, says the lawsuit, referring to the end user license agreement. A few days later, CR sent a DMCA counter notification over the first video. I did nothing. Wow, I love the spelling. I did N-O-T-I-N-G, notting, wrong, R-O-N-G. This strike is all wrong. I was modding a video game that isn't against you. YouTube's toss. Why was I striked? Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. That's his counterclaim.
I would like to shake his English teacher's hand.
It was probably this counter notice that kicked off the unlikely lawsuit to begin with. The way the DMCA counter notices work is that YouTube will keep the contact offline or content offline for 10 days, but the copyright claimant, in this case Epic Games, files a legal action. YouTube has to continue to keep it offline, and that's exactly what Epic Games did before he even realized they were going after a 14-year-old. The fact only came to their attention when CR's mother, Lauren Rogers, sent a letter to the court pointing out CR was a minor, and minors are not capable of consenting to contracts. She never authorized him to play Fortnite, which meant Ceula was not binding on her son. Lauren Rogers...
Way to go, Mom!
Yeah! She's looking at the bill and going, nope! Lauren Rogers isn't wrong per se. It's true that, in general, minors do not have the capability to make contracts. That's why standard EULAs like Fortnite's ask minors to only use the service with the supervision of a parent or guardian who must themselves agree to the EULA. I love the call-out quote, is the I did nodding wrong. By playing Fortnite without his mother's permission, technically speaking, CR is outside the bounds of the EULA. But also, technically speaking, playing Fortnite without being covered under the EULA might be digital trespass or worse, computer fraud and abuse.
Oh, fuck.
Charge him as a hacker for playing without his mother's permission?
Oh.
This is getting stupid. That might sound wild and ridiculous in a world where minors were almost certainly clicking through EULAs without their parents' permission, but the whole underage internet exists on the precarious legal fiction that all of these teens are being supervised by their parents, who are bound by these contracts that no one is actually reading. Oh, that's that whole paragraph right there is true.
And that's where the judge should just go and case dismissed.
Yes. Like, let's see. Well, I mean, technically, Europe just put a EULA on everybody's software. It's called the GDPR. Look that up if you want to see something funny. Because they're basically claiming if a European uses your website, you are subject to our rules.
Wow.
So the day after the GDPR went live, one of the most quickly growing software services that was just making tons of money was software to block European users.
Wow.
Because they didn't. I mean, they gave notice on this. It's been coming up for. I've been hearing about it for at least 3 months, so I imagine its notice has been getting around. But yeah, GDPR is interesting. You should look into that sometime, or you'll get a kick out of it.
Yeah, I will.
So let's see. CR isn't distributing.
How many beers am I going to need to read it?
It depends on which summary you pull. If you pull the actual thing, like a case, because it's legal document. Right, it's okay. European legal document.
Jesus!
A lot of the privacy advocates really like it, but from a software development side, it's pretty restrictive, and their enforcement claims are kind of nuts. It's like if you're in America, Galaxy 15 hosted in the United States. I live in the United States. We all use pseudonyms, but if a European, well, we don't save anybody's information because I don't let anybody post or set up forums or anything, but I guess the IRC, although technically that's Freenode. So I guess if we had a forum and a European signed into that forum, we're now subject to GDPR. I don't know how you enforce that, but apparently. So
we used to have Swedish listeners. We might still do.
Yeah, but I'm not saving any information about them, so it doesn't matter. But
yeah.
I mean, actually, I have no clue how many people even listen to the show.
I mean, demographics.
Say what?
Even the age demographics, you have no control over that.
I have no clue. I was ready to kill the show because I thought like two people listened to it, but I got a whole bunch of feedback saying that wasn't the case. So it's like, okay, well, I actually have no clue how many people actually listen. I've gotten some feedback, so I know that there's more than two. But I honestly, like, you know, gun to my head, how many people listen to the show? I have no clue.
Oh, we're going big. I'm fucking famous. 18 billion. We've got aliens, motherfucker.
I know of two.
Aliens listen.
So I can confirm there's two people who claim they listen. So technically there's usually more hosts than listeners, but I don't think that's actually the case. So anyways, where were we with the article? I completely lost the plot here. CR isn't distributing a modified copy of the game. He didn't write a cheat for the game, which would be potentially be a Section 1201 violation, similar to how bypassing DRM on software is a copyright violation. He posted a link to the cheat, but linking out to something isn't strictly illegal. The copyright infringement that Epic Games is claiming is twofold. First, when CR clicked and ran the cheat file, the cheat injected code into his local Fortnite files, modifying them into something different from the copyrighted work. Wouldn't that be a derivative work? The moment he clicked, he created a derivative work, thus infringing copyright. Oh, okay, yeah, I could have just kept reading. You could argue that it's fair use, and in fact, it's not a total loser of an argument, regardless of the fact that Fortnite EULA forbids the creation of derivative works. Second, when CR livestreamed the game, Epic argues that he infringed copyright by publicly displaying and or publicly performing the unauthorized derivative work. Considering how much, you know, Epic wants people streaming this game, that's a hell of a twist. Not only that.
That's with them claiming derivative work, they're still saying, if you're legitimately playing, feel free to stream this shit. You just can't stream if you have cheats in. So Twitch is completely fine with this.
Yeah. It's likely that both CR and his mother were thrown off by the language of the complaint. Most people, after all, are deeply unfamiliar with how weird copyright is and how bizarrely broad it can get in the digital context. When Epic's complaint started talking about using computer software that injects code into Fortnite's code, which then materially modifies and changes Fortnite's code, and thereby creates an unauthorized derivative work of Epic's copyrighted Fortnite code, it sounds terribly officious. But that long drawn out sentence is referring to the moment CR clicked on and ran a cheat. They're also claiming he modified their game to use the cheat and live streamed it. This would, of course, fall under the Copyright Act if he did, in fact, modify their game. Well, what if it's happening in memory? That's actually a question. But seriously, because to run their code, to use their code, you have to copy it into the memory of your computer from your disk. So if you're changing it in memory and not saving it, I don't know that it's a derivative work, because it's sort of like, it's sort of like playing music through a stereo system with a second track playing under it, so like a DJ setup. Well, I don't. Dude, maybe.
There is not 12 people in a fucking jury are going to understand that, Morps.
There's not 12 people in a fucking jury who are going to understand this as it is.
I've won on this case.
Well, since it should be a civil case, I don't know that there'll even be a jury, but. Let's see. They're also claiming Epic has no capability of proving any form of modification, since in the next breaths she adds that her son obtained existing cheats from a website with public view, not affiliated with Epic Games, Inc. It seems likely that she doesn't understand that the complaint reference to a modification has nothing to do with whether or not CR wrote the cheat. I may add a multitude of other individuals have and currently are doing this. As this letter is being typed, her primary contention, it seems, is that everyone does it, so why is her son being singled out?
Because he streamed it. It's kind of like everyone beats a baby to death with a brick and then tosses it into a garbage can.
Yeah, it looks
not everyone live streams it on YouTube.
So I just clicked it and checked, and it started to play. So anybody in the stream maybe even heard the guys say, yo, what's going on, guys? Because they've got it linked in the article. In a probably unwise video posted on October 29th, CR echoed those sentiments, freely admitting to the exact thing that Epic Games accuses of. I was cheating, you know, the normal. I'm not going to play it. I'm not going to play it because it's 8 minutes long and I want to move on to other stuff. But, yeah, he actually went on YouTube and basically gave a confession while playing Grand Theft Auto V.
Wow.
Amazing. This is why children should not be allowed on the internet. Then it should free up some bandwidth for me.
I never made... Yeah, he says, I never made the cheat. I never coded the cheat. I never sold the cheat. It's a free hack. You can get it from anywhere. So, yeah, he doesn't understand what they're suing him for. Which I don't blame him.
They're suing him for using it.
His mother should be setting up a Twitch live stream and then beat him fucking live on it.
They're suing him not for using the cheat, but for live streaming the cheat as copyright infringement. Oh, fuck. Let's see. They still have not gotten a lawyer, so they don't understand what they're being sued for, so they have not gotten a lawyer. So,
wow, I would get a lawyer. A good lawyer. I would contact the Internet Freedom Foundation. Is that what they're called?
EFF. The Electronic Freedom Foundation.
Yeah. Foundation. Yeah, because I'd talk to them and see where they... Because they'd have an understanding of what you're being sued for.
Well, not only that, I hope there's a follow-up story with what happens with this. Because that could actually set some precedent for how video game streaming, cheating, modification of software is handled in the future. Because in all seriousness, you could really stretch this. Like, we don't like what we don't like the review you did of our game. Well, you ran it at the wrong resolution, and that's therefore a derivative work, and we're now suing you for copyright infringement. And I know some game companies have already pulled this shit a few years ago when YouTube reviews first started getting big. If you gave them a bad review, they'd often copyright strike people. But if they have a legal foot to stand on by saying modification of the game is a derivative work and it really is copyright infringement, at that point you just get into, well, what counts as a modification? Because that could get squirrely quick.
I don't know. I'm fairly certain you'd have to actually modify the code. Changing the resolution setting on my monitor doesn't do that.
Oh, I'm not talking about legitimate claims. I'm talking about them using that as an excuse to shut people down.
All right.
So
they should list the name of this case.
They did. Epic Games versus Rogers, or whatever it was.
Copy paste it.
The link's in the TeamSpeak if you want to pull it up and get it. It's in there.
I've got it.
Yep.
I've got it open right now.
Cool.
Or at least for the article.
Anyways, next article is from the Register. IBM bans all removable storage for all staff everywhere. IBM has banned its staff from using removable storage devices. This thumb drives, flash drives, portable hard disks. In an advisory to employees, IBM Global Chief Information Security Officer Shyamala Naidu said the company is expanding the practice of prohibited data transfer on all removable storage devices, e.g. USB, SD card, flash drive. The advisory stated some pockets of IBM have had this policy for a while, but over the next few weeks we're implementing this policy worldwide. Big Blue is doing this because of the possible financial and reputational damage from misplaced, lost, or misused removable storage devices must be minimized. IBMers are advised to use Big Blue's preferred sync and share service to move data around. The advisory also admitted the move may be disruptive for some. He's not wrong. The Register understands that frontline IBM staff sometimes need to download patches so they can be installed on devices they manage for clients, and that bootable USB drives are one of the means of installing those patches. Indeed, IBM has a guide on installing Power9 on servers using USB key. So, it's a big change. That's hard because a lot of companies try to do that. Hell, I'm trying to do that where I work. And actually, I need to send this link to my boss now that I think about it.
Well, could they make an exception to the rule for like patch updates for computer systems? Because I don't think they're worried about someone having a Windows patch on a CD key. I think they're worried about sales documents on thumb drives.
They are. They're worried about anything with PII data on it, making it onto a flash drive or embarrassing emails or whatever. Because if you monitor what goes on in your software, try to do DLP and stuff like that in your environments, the moment a file is on a flash drive, you've lost control of it. Because, you know, even if you know, you have something that would like, oh, that's got PII in it, I should delete that. The moment it's on a flash drive, all they got to do is unplug it before your software can do anything, and you have lost control. And you can take it to an unmanaged system, and there is no, some companies will sell, this makes this document phone home, but that assumes that, you know, you've gotten your management hooks in there in the first place. So it's just just from a practical standpoint, yeah, once the file's on there, you don't have any control over it on what's on a flash drive. Plus, there's also the old dropping flash drives in the parking lot, and this, you know, not allowing people to use flash drives totally defeats that attack. So From a security standpoint, it's a really good move. From a practicality standpoint, it's going to be really frustrating for a lot of people. So.
Maybe it's just where I work, it's already set up to keep almost everything internally. Very few departments would actually need an external device to move data.
Usually your IT department does for doing, you know, maintenance on systems, patches, things like that. Salespeople often need it because they're usually, you know, have presentations and stuff like that on flash drives and don't always have reliable internet connection.
A lot of sales are issued a laptop. That's your computer. You just hook it up to the projector.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there are ways around a lot of this, and they're talking about using their cloud sharing system. I've already forgotten what it was called, but, you know, Dropbox, Box, OneDrive, tons of ways to get around some of this stuff. Like I said, I don't know. I think it's a good move from a security standpoint, but it can be really frustrating if that's how you're used to doing things. I mean, you know, I've actually considered opening up my work laptop and sticking a larger hard drive in it just because I was using a little portable SSD to run virtual machines just because the internal drive in my work laptop's almost full. So, I don't know. It's just one of those things where it's like, I need storage and I really don't want to wait on an order. So, yeah, there's other situations that are totally benign. But at the same time, if you're running virtual machines off a flash drive or, you know, booting an alternative operating system off a flash drive, you are getting around all kinds of controls because most of the controls companies put in their images in their issued laptops and desktops is actually installed in Windows. So if you have a bootable flash drive with another OS on it, another copy of Windows, a Linux, or something like that, you defeat a lot of their controls. So, but anyways, it's an interesting move. You saw that article too. What'd you think?
I would have thought it was already banned.
A lot of places already have.
Yeah.
So
when I saw that article, I seriously, IBM, really? You're late to the party, man, when it comes to security. Well, they really trust their employees not to take their files.
And just for other practical reasons, it just hasn't come up.
Yeah.
So, anyways, next article is from the Orlando Sentinel. The attorney who has filed several unsuccessful lawsuits after 250 Disney IT workers lost their jobs to Indian nationals in 2014 acknowledged Wednesday that it is a legal fight she cannot win. "We have lost," Sarah Blackwer said during a news conference in Orlando. "Unfortunately, we lost because it's legal." The information is we actually covered this article.
We did. Jeez. I remember talking about it.
It would have been around 2014, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was shitty for them back then, and it's even shittier today. Because if I remember correctly, they had to train their replacements
they
for
did.
3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Or they wouldn't get their severance, yeah.
Yeah.
Information technology workers' grievances became a national headline after some were forced to train their replacements in 2014, putting a spotlight on the issue of H-1B visas. Some Americans were rehired for other jobs within the company, while others became unemployed or decided to retire. Blackwell filled out four unsuccessful lawsuits at the state and federal levels, and after the most recent was dismissed by the state, she said she will not plan to refile again. And one of the cases, a federal judge said Disney was following the existing immigration laws. "As we've said all along, these lawsuits are completely baseless," a Disney spokesperson said in a statement Wednesday. Does Disney make their lawyers wear those mouse ears to when they go into court? Because
I hope so.
I wouldn't put it past them.
God, that's just put a great image in my head. It's fantastic, whoops.
Anyways.
But, another reason why Trump won.
Yeah, he did say he was going to do stuff about the H-1Bs, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blackwell vowed to keep fighting for the issue by advocating and creating public awareness, she told reporters at the news conference. Under President Donald Trump, whom Blackwell accused of not doing enough to help the Disney workers, immigration and the H-1B visa has generated a hot-button political debate. a primary avenue for skilled immigrants to enter the United States. The H-1B visa for specialty workers is heavily used in the tech industry. About 85,000 visas are issued annually in a lottery system. Some critics argue that they are a way for companies to avoid hiring U.S. citizens. Trump himself has said H-1B recipients shouldn't even be considered skilled. Yeah, depends. I've seen some that were and some that weren't. An Associated Press investigation in 2017 found that some H-1B workers, particularly in jobs such as computer science, are often paid less than their American counterparts. No shit. They've got them by the short and curlies.
No, they can't leave. They can't find another job in the U.S. They're not slaves because they're getting paid, but they can't leave the company that brings them in. The company has no reason to give them more money than their starting pay.
Blackwell also voiced frustration with politicians, including Trump, for not doing more to create change. "We truly believed in him," said Blackwell, a Republican Saratoga attorney who, according to the Saratoga Herald Tribune, was considering running for a state House seat in 2016 and spoke about the Disney fight at Trump rallies during his campaign. What has Trump done? Nothing. Well, yeah, he hasn't really done much with H-1Bs, has he?
There's a question of how much can he do.
Yeah.
If it was actually passed by Congress, there's not a lot. One reason he's been able to ice the Iran deal and a few other things he's done is that the previous administration didn't actually pass those through Congress. They weren't actually laws. It was all executive discretion.
Yeah.
So depending on how much executive discretion there is in the H-1 program, he won't be able to do anything without Congress's help.
Yeah, he would actually need them to pass a law.
He'll need 60 votes.
No, depending on what they're doing, he won't. And depending on the law, I don't think the Dems would filibuster him on it, because this would look really bad on them. They're supposed to be the party of the worker, traditionally, especially unions.
Well, dude, so, considering a lot of their money comes from Silicon Valley, I think they'd be hard-pressed not to fight against it. Because Silicon Valley won't want to lose their slaves.
They wouldn't want to lose their slaves, but votes count more than money. It's kind of an example, and it is a political one. The National Rifle Association doesn't donate very much money to campaigns, especially when you look at the percentage of money people are receiving. The reason everyone fears the NRA isn't that they're buying politicians, is that they have a very, very, very active voter base.
Oh, yeah. So, they pull a lot of political clout.
Yeah, so it's not that we're buying politicians, it's that our members aren't going to vote for you, and the people that believe like us aren't going to vote for you. And when it comes to H-1B visa, if there was a bill put out there limiting it, Zuckerberg won't push it, but the employees of Zuckerberg would vote for it. So at that point, they might give me $10 billion, but that's not going to get me elected, and I can only take so much of that money home. The rest sits in a war chest for me to get elected. So there isn't enough money to replace the votes I could lose.
Yeah, all right, I see it. I concede. You got it.
All right, let's...
He would have to use political capital to actually get it done, and he hasn't mentioned it on the whole Donald thing.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'd like to see him. I mean, we've talked about the H-1B thing a couple of times on decking, and I would like to see.
I don't think it should just be the Bs. I think a lot of the H-1 visas should be, if not done away with, because some of them actually could be useful. I want to see them restricted, because I've seen a lot of people with trying to get in the beginnings of the tech industry, but they can't because all the lower level rungs are being outsourced, and it's kind of hard to move into something higher without experience.
Yeah.
So I the way I would, I'm just thinking of my own experience. It's not that I want them to get rid of H-1B visas. It's that because they're supposed to be a skilled thing, I'd like him to actually make sure that people are skilled before they let him use the H-1B. Because I've had some bad experiences with people on H-1Bs who, I'm pretty sure just lied.
Do the needful? I have done the needful. It's going to be my favorite joke when it comes to that.
You know, they just didn't know anything, and they, everybody ends up covering for them just because things have to get done, and then they come in and claim they were integral members of the team, and it's like, no, you didn't do jack. But
I have a picture of boob and vagine. I did help.
I can't dispute that, are you?
Casual racism.
So.
I'm as bad as Nickelback. Boy, he with the Nickelback file.
I don't even want to go there. Anyways, wow, we've been talking a bit. Next one is from ZDNet. GitHub has exposed a bug, or GitHub has said a bug exposed some user passwords in plain text. The code repository site, which more than 27 million users as of last year, sent out an email to affected users Tuesday. During the course of regular auditing, GitHub discovered that recently introduced bug exposed a small number of user passwords to our internal logging system, said the email received by some users. The email said that a handful of GitHub staff could have seen the passwords, but it's unlikely that the GitHub staff accessed the internal logs. We have corrected this, but you need to reset your passwords to regain access to your account, the email said. ZDNet reached out to several users who received the email and verified its authenticity. It's not known how many users received the email or reached out to GitHub prior to publication, but not immediately hear back. If that changes, we'll update. It's unclear how exactly this bug occurred. GitHub's explanation was that it stores user passwords with bcrypt, a stronger password hashing algorithm, but that the bug resulted in our secure internal logs recording plain text user passwords when users initiated a password reset. Rest assured, these passwords were not accessible to the public or other GitHub users at any time. GitHub said it has not been hacked or compromised in any way. In 2016, the company reset some passwords after it found some accounts had fallen victim to a password reuse attack where credentials were used on other sites. So, this sounds bad, but to boil it down in plain English, GitHub was accidentally logging the plain text passwords when somebody reset them. And these were just going to an internal logging system. And so GitHub has said, okay, no, anybody whose account was affected, we're going to make you reset your password, and we fixed it. This is actually really good behavior on GitHub's part. Because these passwords were only exposed in internal logs. They weren't public. I know a lot of managers. Let me rephrase. I am aware of a lot of people who, given what this was, would have just deleted the logs and called it a day. They wouldn't have made a fuss. They wouldn't have said anything. They wouldn't have told anybody about it. They would have just buried it, called it done. And honestly, nobody probably would have ever known because it's all internal stuff. If they cleared out the logs and scrubbed the logs, nobody'd even know. Worst case, you know, a handful of your internal employees might have seen something, but if you didn't trust them, why do they work for you? So I could totally see a lot of people just ignoring it and going on, but GitHub actually did the right thing here. They announced it, they reset the affected accounts, and they're moving on. So I say kudos to GitHub for doing the right thing here.
Yeah, I do too. As you said, a lot of that happened. A lot of people would just go, and fuck it. At least they notified their customers.
Yeah, they notified it, and they said they corrected the problem. So, I mean, that's actually really good behavior because, well, like I said, I am aware that some IT practices would just ignore that, just kind of clean it up and not say a word and move on because, gee, that would look bad for the company, wouldn't it? But no, I think this looks great. This shows that they're being responsible stewards of people's data. I don't know. Madman, you have any thoughts?
They've already been said. So long as it was prompt, I think they did a good job.
So, all right. So, what's next? Next article is from The Verge, and I'm not going to actually read the whole article, even though it's fairly short. I can summarize it because I've been reading up on this. Google is expanding what Chromebooks can do. Specifically, they're going to be able to run Linux apps inside of they're calling it a virtual machine. I'm betting it's going to be more of a container. But it makes sense because Chrome OS was originally based on Ubuntu. Then it was based on Gentoo. And now I'm fairly certain it's their own SKU. It's like, you know, they just build it up as their own distro. But Chrome OS is Linux. So it's always been kind of funny that it actually cannot run Linux apps, but it can run Android apps. This is actually pretty cool. Because when they publish this, you know, and of course at first it's only going to be for the Google's top-of-the-line, stupid, expensive, what is it, Chromebook Pixel? It's like a $1,200 Chromebook of all things. It's like, good God. If you're going to spend that kind of money, get a real laptop, right? But
exactly.
They said they plan on releasing it for all Chromebooks. I think the schedule I saw said end of the year. So, because they're hoping that developers will use it for like running Android Studio and stuff like that on top of Chromebooks, doing app development and stuff like that on Chromebooks. And honestly, given the hardware and the things, if they're writing like cloud apps, web pages, mobile apps, things like that, work fine. And, you know, this is cool because you could actually take a Chromebook, install a bunch of Linux apps, and take the little $200 lightweight Linux laptop and use it as a Linux laptop and not as a Google monitoring device. So I think this is cool because you'll actually be able to do, like, put Firefox on it and put a terminal on it and actually make it into a fairly useful little, you know, Chromebooks. You can get those for $150 if you get the right one.
Yeah.
And usually the batteries on those last pretty good long time too, so you're not going to be playing any Fortnite, but depending on your needs. So I think this is cool, especially because I have a little Samsung Chromebook, and I like using it from time to time. But until they added Android apps, I wouldn't have really considered it. So I load the Brave browser as an Android app on my Chromebook so I can use it.
Nice.
Works fine, by the way, for the most part. So anyways, and finally for this last story, I wasn't certain if I needed a theremin or not, but my soundboard player is pretty much, the buttons to play sound effects are pretty much dead at this point, so I'm going to have to cheat here in a minute to play the Digital Dojo theme. But this one's from Ars Technica, and I don't know if I need to read the whole story. The headline might just be enough. Don't charge your brain implant during thunderstorms. Doctors warn after incident.
That's it. Done. Headline.
Nope, that's no, that's it.
Don't even need to discuss it.
If you have a cochlear implant and you're plugging your brain into the fucking wall in a thunderstorm.
No, this is one of those ones that does the electrically charged wire for tremors.
Oh.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, it's already designed to fry your brain, and now you're upping the voltage quite a bit.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you were only supposed to get 0.2 milliamps. You had a Led Zeppelin concert playing in your brain for a second.
He's Billy out.
Can you taste blue now, sir?
With a kite and a key and his fucking attached it to his nipple ring.
Doctors in Slovenia report that a 66-year-old woman with an existing brain implant experienced a close call with the device after lightning struck her apartment building. The strike ruined the woman's television and air conditioning unit and managed to switch off her brain implant. Luckily, the woman and her device were not otherwise harmed. DPS devices like the woman's are increasingly used to help treat neurological... Okay, so yeah, luckily at the time of the thunderstorm, she wasn't charging the pulse generator or charging the recharger system, so none of the equipment was damaged, but just the EMP from the lightning knocked the thing out, and they had to get it reset. But anyways, yeah, I love the headline, don't charge your brain implant during thunderstorms.
that should be a PSA.
Like, we need to get dramatic,
my favorite one.
We need to get some dramatic music, some clouds going in the background. You know, the Twilight Zone guy. Hi there. If you have a brain implant.
Or you go the more shocking one that you show kids, you know, little Timmy and Sally are outside, they're playing in a thunderstorm. Let's recharge.
You just go get one of those scenes out of any 80s movie where they show somebody getting electrocuted and they flip to a skeleton for a minute.
Yeah.
And they flip back and their hair's all up, you know. Anyways, let's Let's see if this thing's gonna behave. Let's see. All right, hopefully the thing will work for the rest of the show, and then I'll remember to charge the damn buttons, button pad. Anyways, first article, or first thing I have for Digital Dojo is very cool if you're setting up a low-trust or very protected Linux system. It's a plugin for sudo called sudo pair. Pretty much, it's a it requires a second human being to approve on sudoing at a root. So it's the tool. It's you know the two key system for getting root access to a Linux box. So if you have a database that's got like I don't know people's credit card numbers and shit like that on there before somebody can get root, well, you need to, you know, have more than one person approve it, and then it actually echoes out everything that's happening on the privileged session to the to a monitoring terminal as well. So. Yeah, it's still in pre-release, but I love the concept and I wanted to throw it out there. And yeah, if you're doing a zero trust system where you have to have multiple people making approvals and stuff like that, so that you don't have one person who's responsible for not patching your Apache systems, Equifax. Well, it's Apache Strut, so technically it'd be a, I think that's a JBoss library. Anyways, yeah, so if, you know, one guy who's not updating your stuff. Anyways, but yeah, it's this is still kind of pre-release, but it's a plugin that will make it so multiple people have to say something's okay before it happens. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the final thing I have for Digital Dojo is a project called Pi 1541. I'll be honest, are you? You might know what a 1541 drive is. I know Madman does not.
The article. Off the top of my head, I'm no clue.
A 1541 is a Commodore disk drive. For like Commodore 128, 64, PETS.
Ah, okay. Yeah, and, never owned a Commodore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's they weren't really big out of the States. I think most of the 8-bits, I know Europe was more Spectrums and ZXs. And what'd you get in Australia? In the 8-bit
for Commodore,
computer.
I have no idea.
For 8-bit
I have
computers.
No idea.
You all didn't do Sinclairs or Spectrums or anything like that?
We had that Amstrad.
Amstrads, okay.
Yeah, the tape deck Amstrads.
Yeah.
Trying to think, and I think IBM.
Everybody would have the early PCs. I think they were pretty worldwide, but the 8-bits, it's kind of funny because they were pretty regional.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the only ones I actually saw was one of my buddies had a Commodore 64, and one of them had an Amstrad. The Amstrad was the green screen setup, but the Commodore 64 was color.
Yep. So I grew up on a Commodore 64, so I love finding shit like this. And when I last moved, I dropped my 1541 drive and ruined it, so I was really upset about that. So functioning 1541s are hard to find.
The fun thing about those old machines was you'd actually put a tape in to play a game, go outside for an hour and a half, kick a ball around, come back and hope it had loaded without fucking missing a file.
So what this does is this uses a Raspberry Pi to emulate the 1541 drive. Now, you do need some hardware to make it work besides just the Raspi. You need some level shifters and a where'd the parts list go? Bit of perf board, a momentary switch, and let's see where to go. I2C bi-directional logic level converter for 8 channels. So what that's doing is that's converting the voltages between what's on the Raspberry Pi's GPIO pins to something the Commodore can deal with. If you tried to go without the line level converters, you're going to fry something on one or the other, because I think the Raspberry Pi is on 3 volts and the Commodore's on 5. So you probably don't want to do that, because functioning Commodores are getting rarer and rarer, and Raspis are cheap, but you still don't want to fry it. But the cool thing is, you know, you can get a Raspi for $20-$30 and the little, you know, the circuitry to make it work is probably another $5. You know, solder that up in a cable. So you're probably looking at a grand total of a weekend and maybe $50 investment. And yeah, the closest existing hardware, if you wanted to use SD cards with a Commodore 64, is like an SD to IEC. And those usually go for about $75 on eBay from what I looked at. And, you know, I've been keeping my eyes out for a cheaper one ever since I dropped my 1541 drive. oops. So, because I've got like three, I've got three Commodores over in the corner that I can't use because I don't have a functioning disk drive for any of them. And I'm not going to spend hours typing the code in. So, now I
remember the code books.
Oh, yeah, I had a couple.
Buy them from the newsstand, sit there and type them all in and realize you've missed a semicolon somewhere.
Yep. So, but the nice thing is, too, this, with this one, you can download disk images off the internet and probably play all the old classic games. I don't even know what the legal status is for a 30-year-old computer at this point when it comes to the copyright on games. It's not so much that, I mean, I know copyright's like, you know, 120 years plus the life of the author plus the life of the Disney Corporation, but it's a case of, does anybody still care about copyrighting these ancient games?
Don't stream while you're operating cheats.
Yeah, that's probably the case. Let me cheat at Pac-Man and stream it.
Man, actually, look at how I can always eat those ghosts.
Actually, the guy who held the world record for Donkey Kong got found out as a fraud. He was using an emulator.
And as our data clearly shows, humans cannot be trusted.
Oh, what, like fastest Donkey Kong run?
No, like the highest score.
So was he actually cheating, or he was just using an emulator and doing like save states and shit?
He was using an emulator. The guy's a douchebag to start with.
Oh, that never helps.
Yeah, like it's been an ongoing. There's a whole documentary about it anyway, but it's just now, 2018, that he had been stripped of everything for using emulators.
Yeah. Like, well, you know,
I'd recommend watching the documentary. It's quite interesting.
I don't know that I would really knock anybody for just using emulators if they were playing it straight. You know what I mean? Because getting some of this old hardware working again, like, you know, classic arcade machines, old school, you know, Commodores aren't so bad because they're enough of them are out there and they're cheap enough on eBay that you can order two or three broken ones and probably cobble a working one together. Functioning NESs, of course, are easy because they're mass produced. Ataris, on the other hand, aren't quite as common as they used to be.
Especially the wall panel ones.
Yeah, because, I mean, and you know, people didn't keep them. They threw them away. They got damaged. Yep. And it's not so much that you can't find them. It's that you can't find them in really good working state. So you almost need like a, you know, electronics engineering degree to go in and fix these things. Or really a lot of time on YouTube watching people who fix them up. But the other problem that you run into really quickly with modern equipment versus old school consoles is like my big screen downstairs. It only has HDMI ports on it. It doesn't have any RGB going into it. I'd have to buy an adapter if I wanted to hook a console up to it, a classic console.
Okay.
Oh, and depending on how old the game is, didn't some of the like graphics run off of the processor clock speed or something?
Yep.
Like the cycles? So if you stick it on a modern like processor, good luck seeing the guy jumping around.
Yeah, so you either need a... you're talking about the emulators. No, usually the emulators are good at getting the speed right. But if you take a... Like, if you want to play a real SNES or a real NES on a modern TV, you're going to have to get some kind of a converter box and hope that it doesn't introduce lag or anything weird like that.
Old VCR.
Yeah,
so an old VCR before digital. Otherwise, anything older than a PlayStation 1, I think it is. Oh, PlayStation 2. You're gonna need to run it through, and this is the cheapest way of doing it: an old VCR. Otherwise, you won't get sound, and you will get lag. I know I'm having that problem at the moment.
Yeah, the other way to do it is get your hands on an old TV, but you know, you kind of got the same problem. That old CRTs, when they broke, people just threw them away. And a lot of people just chucked them when they bought the flat screen. So trying to get your hands on an old CRT that's worth a damn to use for consoles is kind of rough. Although I heard lately, I haven't checked, that apparently a bunch of studios threw a whole bunch of broadcast monitors up on eBay not too long ago. So, and apparently those go for fairly cheap. So maybe. But yeah, getting your hands on keeping this old equipment running. So when somebody, you know, just saying, oh, he used an emulator, I don't know that that's a big deal. If he used an emulator and he was cheating or using save states and doing records, you know, it's like when you see the guys do the perfect pixel perfect speed runs on YouTube and shit like that. And it's like, yeah, they're using emulators and save states and, you know, running that area over and over again to get it, you know, pixel perfect. It's like, no, there's no skill there.
Talking, I found the documentary. It's old, The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, and I will give you the link. The full documentary is up on YouTube.
Oh, fun.
And put that in the show notes for anybody who wants to watch it.
Yeah, we'll put that in show notes.
It's interesting.
Throw that in the IRC while we're at it as well. And
it's also a pretty nice flashback to the 90s, so you'll get a bit of comfy factor.
The other thing, actually, not too long ago, I picked up an RS-97 retro game handheld. I got it off Amazon. It's like $60. It's got a MIPS chip in it. It's running some kind of a Linux, but I'm thinking it's an old cell phone board that somebody's reworked. Because it's got some interesting things. They obviously started with the plastic housing from somebody who was trying to make a knockoff Game Boy, like Game Boy Advance, or maybe even just an emulator for the old hardware, because it's got a Game Boy slot on it. But it's not wired as a Game Boy slot. It's wired as an SD card slot. And it comes with a SD card. It comes with a cartridge that goes in the cartridge slot. But all it is some through wires to a micro SD card housing. And you can look at the circuit board and see that it's literally just the cartridge slot in this handheld console is an SD card. It's just the wires are straight through. So why they did it this way, I guess, is so that they didn't have to redo the plastic housing. But anyways, when you flash a better ROM on it, the thing runs great. I've been playing the shit out of some old Game Boy games and some SNES games on it. And actually, I ran the battery all the way down, so I got it plugged in downstairs. But
a lot of battery issues.
Well, it uses an old Nokia cell phone battery. So I'm pretty sure whoever built this thing cobbled it together out of whatever they had in their warehouse. But you can get them on Amazon fairly cheap, and they work really well with the right ROM on them. The stock ROM's okay, but here's the really funny part. The stock ROM on it has several hundred ROMs on it. It's not like complete collections, but it's got a lot of good ROMs on it already. It came from Amazon that way. Like several hundred SNES and NES and Game Boy ROMs on it. And it's like, wait a minute. I thought I was just getting a device. I didn't know it was coming with all this stuff on it. But
that's cool.
Yeah, because I was just going to load the ROMs I had on it, but it actually works really nice. So that's not bad. But of course, these things are like Chinese knockoff crap, right? So I order one and get one that's great. Somebody else may order one and get a piece of absolute garbage, right?
So yeah, it's hit and miss.
Although,
especially if some dude just building them himself, or
I'm wondering. I am really wondering just on the mix of hardware in the thing, because also the way you flash a new ROM on it. Take it apart, and it's not got security screws or anything. Just standard little hex heads, or standard little, you know, Phillips heads. And under a piece of sticky pad is a 4 gig micro SD card. So it has an SD card reader in the cartridge slot, and then it has a second SD card that it, you know, runs the OS from. So you just, you know, download the new ROM, flash it on there, and pop the new SD card in there inside the unit, and now you're running the new ROM. And like I said, it runs great. The stock ROM had some problems, like the sound was delayed. It was weird, but open RS-97. No, hang on, I'll find it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Travis 97 Open Dingo. I don't know why it's called Open Dingo, but it's Open Dingo. That's the ROM I flashed on it. And yeah, Cool Boy Retro Game RS 97 runs Open Dingus. Open Dingux. So it's actually kind of a like I used to have a Game Park GPX2. It reminds me of that, but it works way better. So, anyways,
that sounds cool.
That's something I've been playing with lately. But that's all I've really got, and I've been out of beer for a while now. So, are you closing
it's
thoughts?
Time. I don't really have any today. Just check out that documentary. I guarantee anybody who's used to like playing in arcades in the 90s, you'll get a little flashback.
Yeah, I threw it in the IRC. I'm definitely throwing. I'll throw it in the show notes as well. Madman, closing thoughts.
I'm looking forward to seeing how the cheating case ends up. I've actually saved the name in a notepad. I want to do some Googling on it later on in a few months, see if they have anything.
Cool.
Oh, dude, 2 years from now, we'll talk about this case and how this kid's pretty much bankrupted his family. And, yeah, no one plays Fortnite, but fuck it, they'll still destroy this kid's life.
Especially for a free game.
Yeah.
So, oh yeah, Psychosis, really enjoying your recommendations on TV viewing from a couple of weeks ago as well. So.
Oh, great. Oh, cool. Just, yeah, if you're looking for other good shows, man, The Horror, that's a good one. Oh, no, it's the... Oh, God, now I can't think of it.
Well, he was talking about Catching Fire and Good Luck Son.
Yeah. Let me just quickly pull up this other one for you. So, I think it's The Horror.
Anyone else watch Anon yet?
I haven't watched that one yet, no.
No, I haven't.
It's another one of the Netflix original movies. Very kind of Ghost in the Shell-esque.
That's kind of thinking our Altered Carbon kind of had a good Ghost in the Shell thing going on, too. So.
This one isn't quite download your brain into something else, but it deals with augmented reality a lot. And then just the kind of question of what if this was in your brain and then the cops could see everything you see?
You can throw that in the IRC for Psychosis there. It's called The Terror. 8 episodes in, and it's fantastic, my friend. Anyway, we should wrap this up. We're nearly an hour and 40.
Are we really? Damn. All right.
Yeah.
That's all I've got for today. Listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Literally, actually, last week, and we did a lot of work on it. Pure Decking every Thursday, unless, you know, shit happens. The Galaxy 15 radio site and the subreddit is probably still the best way to get a hold of me. So, anyways, that's... That's it. I'm going to play the Pac-Man sound.